This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Henry Morgenthaler died peacefully at his home May 29th, just having reached the age of 90. The mainstream media immediately reported his passing, but despite the important honors he had been accorded in his later years, many of the media fell back into framing his life as bound by two polar opposites, supposedly equivalent, revered and hated, wrote the Globe and Mail, heralded and vilified, wrote the New York Times, polarizing, wrote the Toronto Sun, and mass murderer, the National Post. To recall the life and importance of the work of Henry Morgenthaler, particularly the contribution he made to the lives of thousands and thousands of women in Canada, we have reached Carolyn Egan in Toronto. Carolyn is a founding member of the Ontario Coalition for Abortion Clinics. She worked together with Henry Morgenthaler in the campaign to free women in this country from the denial of a basic human right, one they always deserved but were long denied. As a friend of Henry Morgenthaler, you attended an intimate private funeral service. How did the family memorialize his life?
Well, it was quite a lovely ceremony, and it started with a young man singing a Yiddish song, which had been the anthem of the Jewish partisans during World War II. And people may be aware, or perhaps not, that Henry's father had been a leader in the textile, the Jewish textile union in Lodz in Poland, and he was an active member of the Bund, which was a Jewish socialist organization. And when the Germans first came into Poland, he was taken immediately, arrested, and killed by the Gestapo. And he was a major figure in the community there. And the funeral both started with that. And it ended again with a beautiful poem song, also in Yiddish, which was entitled "The Future," and it was a song of the Bund, and I mean some of the words. A friend of mine who knew Yiddish and they said this as well were very, very moving. They said, "We are fighting for a world without masters. Keep courage in the ranks, comrades. Keep courage in the ranks." And I think this really spoke to the tradition that Henry grew up in Poland. And so many people asked, well, what motivated Dr. Morgenthaler to do what he did? And there are many reasons, of course, the women who came to him in Montreal looking for abortions, which were not available to them. But I think the family made it very clear in the ceremony that took place that he was very, very much motivated by that that tradition, that socialist Jewish tradition, and it was something that he felt very, very strongly about his whole life. So it was very, very moving.
It's wonderful to hear that, because so many of the accounts right now in the question of the survivors of Nazism in Europe, Jewish survivors, emphasizes the tragedy, the destruction, etc. And it seems that for Henry Morgenthaler, he drew lessons and strength for continuing a struggle for justice with a kind of optimism.
Very much so, very much so. And he, to at least our knowledge, never thought of giving up the campaign, giving up the struggle, and he had a tremendous reverence and respect for his father and the role his father played in their community in Poland.
What was Henry like as a person? You knew him not just as a public figure, but you knew him in terms of a human being.
Yes, well, and I mean, I've known him since the early 80s, if not before, and worked very, very closely with him through the whole campaign through the 80s and had been a friend since that time. Henry was really a wonderful man. He was a jovial fellow. He loved a joke. He was a very generous friend. He was a wonderful conversationalist, and he was just a wonderful man. And I think that anyone who would have known him would probably have said exactly the same thing. I mean, obviously, in a campaign, a political campaign, as I'm sure you're well aware, there will always be differences and tactics and strategies. And there were. I mean, what role the lawyers would play? Should we build a, you know, how, movement? Should there be an action here, an action there? So obviously there would have been differences, but I always found Henry to be very respectful, talk it out, listen. He had his point of view, and we'd always come to a, I think, a pretty well shared decision on what was the next step to take. And he was a great guy to work with, and I think that you know, as people say, I mean, no one person makes a movement. There's no doubt about that, and I believe very much in my heart that you know, it was the tens of thousands, not more, across the country of women and men who fought and showed that working together collectively, we can really make change in this country. But Henry played a very, very particular role, because at that juncture, when we were trying to figure out what best to do in the early 80s here in Toronto, we felt we needed a doctor to be willing to challenge that law as he had in Quebec and do it publicly. And he had to think that through, but he made that decision at great, great personal cost. There's no two ways about it. And so the role he played was just so instrumental in, I think, our final victory, and that's the way he should be remembered, absolutely.
Yeah, Henry came to Canada at the end of, a few years after the end of World War II, and he got his medical training here. Did he come immediately to concentrate on meeting some of the needs, the vital needs of women for their health?
Well, he initially set up a family practice in Montreal, and he that's what he was doing. But through that family practice, he was coming in contact with women who were in a situation of having an unplanned and unwanted pregnancy, and initially there was nothing he felt he could do about it. But when he saw the situation that they were facing, he made the decision that he would start providing the service. He was a secular humanist. He was involved in the Humanist Association, and he decided that this was something, because of his role as a physician, that he could take a political stand and hopefully change the situation, because he could certainly help the individual women he was dealing with. But I think he understood very clearly that he wanted to change the political terrain in the country, so it would not simply be the women that would be coming to him in Montreal, but women across Canada and Quebec who would be able, therefore, to access a service that he thought should be a basic part of our health care.
Well, as we all know, and you know particularly, it's one thing to decide to provide women a safe abortion, but at that time, abortion was considered a serious crime in the law. There were powerful institutions that wanted that law vigorously enforced and abortion providers imprisoned. What was Henry Morgenthaler's plan to defy the law and ultimately to make it ineffective? How did he proceed in advocating and in acting in ways that led to the success of that campaign?
Well, in the situation in the early 80s in Toronto, in talking with Henry, we saw that Quebec was the only province in the country that had broader access, essentially equal access, you know, across the province. Would be better in a city like Montreal probably than in more rural areas. But the government of Quebec had made the determination, because of Henry and the fact that no jury would convict him of breaking the law, that they would no longer enforce that law in the province of Quebec. And so that was the strategy that was adopted here in Ontario. And we felt that we could do the same, or hope that we would be able to do the same. And when we spoke with Henry, and he agreed to come and open a facility, an abortion facility here, a freestanding clinic, he told us very clearly that this is not something he could do on his own, and he would be willing to do this, but there had to be a movement, a broad-based movement that would fight, with him, alongside him, and build the necessary popular support across the country. I think he and we did believe that the pro-choice perspective was in the majority in this country, but we had to organize that. And we really believe that if the clinic was raided, which we understood it and probably would be, and the doctors arrested, it was he and Dr. Smalling and Dr. Scott, it would undoubtedly go to trial. And we felt that if there was a strong movement, then we would hopefully have the same result as they did in Quebec, that a jury would not find him guilty, even though he clearly broke the law, and that's exactly what happened. And the movement built across the country. British Columbia was a very, very strong area of support for overturning the federal law, and it wound its way to the Supreme Court. And then in January of 1988, the Supreme Court justices ruled to overturn the abortion law. But I think and that had been the plan. It took longer, of course, than we had anticipated. But it was very, very much a clinic becoming a symbol of women's resistance to an unjust law, and a broad-based movement fighting of women and men to show the strong popular support for overturning that law, because we did not believe that Supreme Court justices live in a vacuum. They see what's going on around them, and if the law is not respected, juries will not convict. Then we felt that hopefully they would rule to overturn that law, and in the end they did.
It's quite astounding that in the Quebec situation, he was charged. He did go to court, and juries refused to convict him, even knowing that he was guilty of breaking the law. That kind of disjunction between popular understanding and inherited practices of laws and illegalities is something I don't think we've seen since that time.
No, I think it's rare, and I think the thing was, as I said, we wanted to build a broad-based movement so tens of thousands would feel that this was their struggle across this country, hundreds of thousands most probably. And we also really redefined what choice meant. It was obviously the decision, women should have the democratic decision to decide whether or not to have an abortion. It should not be a therapeutic abortion committee of three doctors whom they never met. But we also talked about all the choices women truly needed in their lives, to be able to be equal participants in this society. They needed decent jobs. They needed the right to child care, an end to forced or coerced sterilization, employment equity, an end to racial and sexual harassment. I mean, in truth, what's called today a reproductive justice perspective, we called it reproductive rights there. And I think because we fought it on those lines, the broad-based movement with a perspective that would allow people, whether you felt that abortion would be ever a decision that you would support or not, was not the key question. It was what would make women able to exercise their rights as a human being in this country. And I think that's the way we were able to get certainly immigrant organizations, women of color groupings in Toronto and across the country. The labor movement came on board in very strong ways because we tried to put it forward with a class and anti-racist perspective that was tremendously important, and I think that helped build that support. And when you build broad support like that, then of course the possibility of winning is so much stronger.
A young TV host asked, when I was going through the internet, there was an interview he had with Henry Morgenthaler, and almost as the first question he asked Henry Morgenthaler, how would you describe yourself? And he seemed taken aback a bit, and Morgenthaler. And then he said with a kind of boyish chuckle, a gentle, nice, intelligent guy. Would you add the word courageous?
Oh, very much. He was very courageous because people have to remember that, I mean, the death threats, the threat to his family, all of that. And as one of his sons, his oldest son, the three sons spoke at the funeral, said he was in his first year of university. Henry had been jailed, and then the government froze all his accounts, and there he was in school. Suddenly the tuition was not being paid. He had nothing to live on, all of that. And these are the things that happened as a consequence of him making the stand that he made. So it's huge, huge impact on his family life, on his children, obviously. But as his son said, you know, they say Henry the difficult hero. He said he wanted to make it clear it was absolutely thrilling to be Henry Morgenthaler's son, and he was so proud of his father. But nonetheless, there were tremendous, you know, difficulties that happened because of the decision he made, being in jail, the heart attack, all of that. And you know, it's courage, absolutely. Very courageous man, and truly a Canadian hero.
Well, thank you very much, Caroline, and congratulations as well, because the successes of the campaign for women's right to choose remain a remarkable achievement, and one from which there still is much to be learned, I would say.
Much to be learned and much to be done. PEI, still there are no abortions. New Brunswick women have to pay. In the interior of BC, Northern Ontario, women still have limited access. So the struggle continues, absolutely. But thank you very much, Mordecai, for the interview. I was happy to do it.
Our guest has been Carolyn Egan. She is a founding member of the Ontario Coalition for Abortion Clinics. She worked together with Henry Morgenthaler in the campaign to free women in this country from the denial of a basic human right, one they always deserved but were long denied.
This podcast was produced by the Red Eye Collective in Vancouver, BC. If you live in the Vancouver area and are interested in creating alternative radio with us, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at redeye@cooperadio.org.